as mentioned earlier, we're looking at our Ephesians reading today, which you'll find on page 1175. If you'd like to turn that way, you might find it helpful. A little bit before my time, but I suspect some of us in the room might remember the eruption of Mount St. Helens in Washington in May of 1980. And it wasn't a sudden event. For 2 months prior to the blast, and earthquakes and volcanic activity had signalled that something big was on its way, something was brewing. The authorities were able to sound the alarm and tell the people living around this volcano that something was coming. And so most people heard the warnings and moved on. There was a man, no relation, by the name of Harry Truman, who was 83 years old. He'd been in, I think, both wars, survived the sinking of his troop ship, and he was not about to leave just because some government officials thought there was danger. He said this, I don't have any idea whether it'll blow, but I don't believe it to the point that I'm going to pack up. And again, there's possibly a slightly American, you know, we're not going to have the government telling me what to do kind of thing going on there. But anyway, the volcano erupted and Mr. Truman's body was never found. It was but him and his lodge were beneath 150 foot of mud and debris. When we're faced with a diagnosis or a warning, we have a decision to make. Is someone warning us because they want to spoil our fun or inconvenience us? Or are we being given a warning because somebody cares about us and wants us to be protected from harm? Sometimes we'd sooner just not know, wouldn't we? Like someone who refuses to check their bank balance or go to the doctors. And as we look at this passage from Ephesians now, we see a warning here. And again, as we read this together, as we go through this, I'd like you to decide what kind of a warning you think this is. So the passage we've just read is an appeal to the Christians of Ephesus to stay away from the way that they used to think and behave. So he says to them right at the beginning, don't live as the Gentiles do in the futility of their thinking. And then what follows is a relatively, I think, quite a devastating and vivid description of the psychology of unbelief. It tells us how we tick. And again, it's got some difficult language in it. And again, we might ask ourselves this question, has God given us this because he's capricious and mean? Or has he given us this because he's kind and caring? What verses 17 to 20 do, right down at the bottom corner of page 1175, that's a realistic view of people and the way that people work, which many psychologists today would agree with. So in verse 18, Paul is speaking about people in their fallen state. This is people without Christ. He says, they're darkened in their understanding, separated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardening of their hearts. And so as you unpack that verse and as you follow it upstream, you see that life lived away from God is something that primarily comes from the heart and not from the head. I think we tend, and again, this is a thing that psychologists would agree with, we tend to make decisions, most of them in fact, not with our brains and our rationality, but elsewhere in us, you know, what we might call our instincts, our intuitions, our wills, our habits, and you know, our hearts. And what we then do is, having decided already what we'd like to do or what our decision is, we then say to our brains, okay brain, your job is to come up with some rational reasons to convince myself why the decision I've already made is the sensible one. That's the way we tend to work. We make these choices with our hearts, and then actually we say to the brain, like, your job is to do the paperwork and get it through. And we make decisions in this way from all the time, from what we have for lunch, who we hire for a job, how we make important decisions. And the same is true of our belief in God. You know, we live in a world where, certainly in the Western world anyway, atheism is considered a perfectly credible way to think. So it's quite easy to come by reasons to say that you don't believe in God. And you know, you'll know these arguments, I suspect. You know, there's no proof of God. What about all the suffering in the world? What about the bits of the Bible that don't track with modern science? How do we explain those? And in my experience, some of the time, these will be genuine roadblocks to belief for somebody. And actually said, you know, I really would like to do this. I want to go more, but I can't get around this. Can you help me? But a lot of the time, I think these sorts of arguments are a smokescreen. They're there to hide what's going on in the heart. And there's a philosopher of science called Thomas Nagel who literally said once, you know, I can't pretend I'm unbiased here. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want there to be a God, he says. I don't want someone there to judge me and to make demands of me. I was having a conversation with someone recently, and I asked her what had made her keep God at arm's length. And again, and she said to me, I just don't understand suffering. Now, I knew this person pretty well. So I was able to ask, is that a question coming from genuine pain and concern, or is it a convenient way to avoid having to deal with Jesus and the demands he makes of you? And again, I knew her well enough that I could say that. And she said, actually, I think probably the latter, if I'm honest. And so what we need, again, it gives us a shift in the way we think about things here. Our darkened understanding about God is not the result of God being unclear about who he is. You know, Romans 1, Psalm 19, the heavens declare the works of God, and other places in the Bible make it quite clear that God has revealed himself in his creation. The problem is that we can't see that, whether we live in a world where people are atheist or not, because our hearts are turned inwards. And the rest of verses up to 20 tells us something of the results of this separation. We have lost all awareness of God. And then we give ourselves over to things that aren't God, whatever idols we find around us. You know, the verses today, I think, are very located specifically in Ephesus. You know, they talk about sensuality and greed. You know, the text in Greek translates better as the word debauchery. You know, maybe that's true for some people, but I can also suspect as you read this, as it talks about where it goes with a life lived without God, indulged in sensuality and indulged every kind of impurity, the continual lust for more. I can imagine some of you thinking, hold on, I've got friends, neighbours, family members who aren't Christians, and they don't live lives that are particularly debauched or scandalous. You know, they're thoughtful, sensible people. And I think Paul himself would also have known people who weren't Christians who were thoughtful and honourable and sensible people as well. So I think we need to do a couple of things with this, with that description. First thing we need to do is see that the letter is written to a particular group of people, and in Ephesus and the places around them, that was the culture that they would have come across. You know, there were the Temple of Artemis employed prostitutes, you know, sex cults, public perversions there, cheap religion and drunkenness at the shrine of Dionysus. In Ephesus, there was probably a shrine to Dionysus as well, who's a god of revelry and drinking, and people would, you know, go there and get drunk and have all sorts of orgies and things like that. And I'd suggest to us that Sutton in 2018 has its similarities, but it's not quite the same as that. Now, that doesn't mean that this passage today is only about back then. This is the ethical and spiritual bankruptcy that Paul describes is as true today as when he wrote those words. Hearts are still darkened, our desires are still warped, we just change the things that we chase after. You know, for some of us, some of our friends, it might be drugs, sex and thrills. It might be comfort, security, social respectability, career or money. You know, as I've said this a few times over the months now, anything, however good, that is not God quickly becomes poisonous when we make it the centre of our lives. So our hearts are hard and our view of God, our minds, our desires are warped. This is our natural state. Well, then, it's clear you must no longer live like that. We go back to verse 1 of chapter 4 that we looked at last week. I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you have received. I'll stop there. I could say, right, okay, go home. Try harder. Try harder to be good. Is that the gospel? Is that good news? Is that going to send you out into this week with joy and hope? Paul tells his readers life doesn't need to be futile anymore because genuine change is possible. Paul tells his readers Jesus is already changing you. Paul tells his readers take off your old life and put on the new one. You were taught and you are being taught in the school of Christ. You'll have heard his voice. And it's the voice of Jesus, it's the power that breaks through the hardness of your heart, your darkness and your ignorance of God. That's why in verse 22 we see this put off your old self. It's a clothing metaphor, it's a very simple one. It's literally you can't put on a new coat unless you've taken off the old one. So when we accept Christ, we say goodbye to certain things in our lives. And we put a new lifestyle on. You know, the old habits, the old practices, the old attitudes go. And we put on this new person. Colossians 3 is really helpful here. Put on as God's chosen people. Holy and loved, compassion, kindness, lowliness, meekness and patience. The result of that is something that we cannot do for ourselves. So Paul's, it's quite complex here what Paul says. He basically says you have to continually do this. But the change, the being made new, is something that happens to you by God's Holy Spirit working in you. So to be made new in the attitude of our minds, to be given a new mind towards God, a new self created. It's wonderful there, isn't that word at the end? It says created to be like God in righteousness and holiness. Puritan John Owen says this, what then is holiness? Holiness is nothing but the implanting, writing, and living out of the gospel in our souls. Holiness is nothing but the implanting, writing, and living out of the gospel in our souls. And verses 25 to 31, we don't have time to go into them in detail this morning, but they give us examples of that old life. As we go down that list, some of us may resonate with some of these more than others. Telling the truth, giving anger its proper place, stopping from stealing, not talking in an unwholesome way, getting rid of all of the poison that used to infect you. In each case, there's a contrast between the old and the new. And again, I think that list is important, but it's not exhaustive. You will know, each of us will know, some examples from our old life that we have managed to change and some which we still are working on. And we come into Christian life expecting sometimes instant transformation. And sometimes we see it. Quick, glorious change. You know, I was talking with someone a few years ago who just became a Christian, or even just before he became a Christian. He'd been smoking 40 cigarettes a day. And he went to bed one night and he said, Lord, I want to stop smoking. And he woke up and the next morning the cigarette tasted revolting to him. He never wanted to touch it again. It's interesting. He said, God healed me instantly of being addicted to cigarettes first time. About 5 years later, he had a cigarette, and it took him another 20 years to kick that habit. So that's a really good image there. For most of the time, it works slowly, and I just want to just suggest three encouragements for you as I finish up this morning with this. First is this, the change into Christ-likeness, the taking off the old and putting on the new, is always a battle. Sanctification is the long word for this. Becoming more like Christ is a battle between the old and the new. And some days will go better than others when you're in this battle against the old self. But being in that battle doesn't mean that you're a bad Christian. It's actually a healthy symptom that you're alive. You know, and I'd suggest if you feel like you're in a battle with sin, then I'd suggest that that is a really, really good sign, because you're in a battle, you're fighting it. The danger sign where you need to be concerned is if you're hearing this and actually you know that you're not battling certain things in your life, you don't hate your sin and you're not desperately desiring it to be gone. That's the question. Are you fighting at the moment a battle against the old self? So again, this is to be encouraged that every saint, I think, who's ever been, every brilliant example of the Christian life, the further they went in to get to know God, the further like Christ they became, the more they found it a struggle to get rid of things. The deep, you know, we're like onions, you keep peeling. you know, and you're dealing, there's always going to be more, and it always goes deeper than you think, your rebellion against God. And I love this quote. I found another one here from Don Carson. He says, "Some Christians want enough of Christ to be identified with him, but not enough to be seriously inconvenienced. They genuinely cling to basic Christian orthodoxy, but do not want to engage in serious Bible study. They value morality, but do not engage in war against inner corruptions. They fret over the quality of the preacher's sermon, but do not worry much over the quality of their own prayer life. Such Christians are content with mediocrity." And so that's a challenging question for us. Are you in a battle today? I want to encourage you with is that change into Christ-likeness is far more internal than it is external. To be renewed on the outside, in terms of your visible patterns of behaviour, is good, but it's not the full deal. Simply trying hard to change your outer behaviour without relying on God, I promise, will not change you. It might make you proud for a while, but you won't be able to keep it up, or you'll just swap whatever bad thing you were doing with something else. Dangerous. We kind of leave here thinking, right, I'm just going to strain with all of my might to just stop doing that thing that I do. But the other side is, I think, equally dangerous. You know, this is just giving up. You know, there's that old phrase, let go and let God. Well, you won't find that in this passage or anywhere in the Bible. Trusting Christ is always hard. He promises nothing less. What you can do is place yourself in such a way that God's grace can meet you and change you. You can't just decide not to be a selfish or impulsive person or whatever it is you know that you're struggling with, any more than an apple tree can just decide to start growing oranges. But what you can decide to do is put yourself where Christ can meet you, reading the Bible, praying regularly by yourself, meeting and talking with other Christians, putting a priority on coming to church and worship together. For the vast majority of Christians who have taken on Paul's exhortation to heart have needed to do those things, those daily graces. So that's the daily pattern of Bible reading and prayer, that's the weekly pattern of worship, and also having fellowship of some kind with Christians who can challenge you and encourage you and support you. And finally, change into Christ-likeness is usually slow. A little image for you, you might see this week. You know, sometimes you see how tree roots can actually warp the pavement underneath them. I love that. You can just imagine when someone planted that tiny sapling, you've got that brand new concrete pavement. You know, how can a little weedy plant like that possibly uproot and shift those tons of concrete? And yet after a few decades, the pavement doesn't stand a chance, does it? That, I think, with our change in Christ, the growth of trees and plants take place so slowly that it's not easily seen. So daily we might notice little change, but a great deal of it is going to be happening under the surface. And again, particularly as we kind of plug into these ways of means of grace, of abiding with God's love by reading the Bible, praying, public worship, these sorts of things, day by day. The majority of it will happen under the surface in a way that you may not even be aware of, but in time we will see that great change bursting through. It's a long work, but it's a work that Christ promises he will complete in each one of his chosen saints. That's the promise that Paul prayed for us all the way back in Ephesians 1 from a few months ago. Remember that one? He prays that the eyes of our hearts would be enlightened and we might know the hope to which God has called us. That will renew our minds, won't it? Knowing the full truth of God's power and promises. That's the same promise that Paul prayed for us in Ephesians 3, that we might have the power to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, to know the love of Christ which surpasses knowledge, that we might be filled with the fullness of God. Your mind is filled with the love of God and the fullness of God. Your mind will be renewed. It will be freed daily, gradually, sometimes painfully, from the futility of the world. And out of that will come new emotions, new habits, new practices that will clothe you with holiness. And the new person that's being made is the creation of God himself, and to him belongs all of the glory, forever and ever. Amen.